And you too. I'm about to have a cheerful afternoon talking about death. This is a subject I think all of us find interesting because we're all going to die. And so it's something that needs to be reflected upon again and again as we reflect every morning in our chanting. Not as a kind of morbid fascination or some kind of negative dwelling on the negative, but bringing into our consciousness the way it is, life, the being born, and then the conscious experience, and then the death is the story of everyone's life. This is what we all. This is a description of the pattern of all existence. Death, separation, and grief. We have, when we live in this form as a human being, we tend to, because we have a retentive memory. We hold in our minds the memories of those who have died before we die, and we're very much aware of death as an ever-present possibility. Even if no one close or someone we know has died yet, at least the cat or the dog or the goldfish, something has died in our lives that we felt, we've experienced grief. Childhood, my cat died. I remember I was very fond of this cat, and when it died, there was a real sense of grief, loss, separation from the loved. Then as one lives longer and sees parents and friends and relatives, one hears about the deaths of very famous people that you've heard of. Or in monastic life, the great teachers, Ajahns, of Thailand. In my life as a monk, there's been quite a few of them die. And more you see that as one gets older, this is an ongoing reflection. In a society that has a kind of dread and fear, resistance to contemplating the experience of life, it seems like so much of the effort and energy of modern materialism, modern society, is to affirm conscious living as the ultimate, is the most important thing to enjoy life, to find happiness while you're alive. It gives so much importance to attainments, to success, to youth, to good health, to attractive appearance, that the other side of life, the aging process, and the degenerating diseases, the loss of the senses, the weakening of the senses, the deafness, blindness, loss of strength, and then the inevitable death of the body are regarded as subjects to avoid, not polite, not they're depressing to people. But they needn't be, because they're something that we all will experience or are experiencing, and it means that this is a part of our life experience. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing that shouldn't be. It is the way it is, and it always has been this way. And therefore, this is something to contemplate and consider and even treasure, take an interest in, rather than just dismiss as negative or depressing or impolite conversation. Here at Amavati, over the past several years, we've given death and dying retreats on the weekends. And that means we contemplate this subject. We don't die on the retreats. No one has yet, by the way. They're quite safe. But the subject surprises. It's surprising. And also, I feel quite pleased that these death and dying retreats usually have waiting lists. People, you can only accommodate so many people on a retreat for the weekend, and so you have to limit it to 40, 50 people. And every time we give one of these, there's a waiting list, people wanting to attend it that have applied too late. And there's been a lot of literature made available over the past decade on death and dying. I remember I gave a dialogue with Dame Cicely Saunders in London a couple of years ago at a friend's meeting house in London, and she was one of the kind of founders of the hospice movement. And she's quite famous even in the United States as a kind of the pioneer for hospices. And this, of course, started here in England, but now it's quite a strong movement in the States. And it's a good sign. To me, it's a sign that in spite of all the kind of dreary, gloomy signs that we read about in the newspapers, the British economy and so forth, we... As a society, I like to think that it's a good sign, a maturing as a society, where we're no longer just trying to, you know, here in Britain, we're not trying to become a superpower. We're not interested in establishing an empire, or that kind of energy, that kind of enthusiasm no longer is a part of our experience in this country. Britain had its day as an empire, as a kind of world power, superpower, a colonial empire, and those kind of glorious moments, quote glorious, unquote, moments, depends on how you see it or what you read, the literature you read, but the fact that kind of attitude and that kind of happening was at an age where, say, was a much more youthful age. A sense of getting, attaining, achieving, dominating, conquering, spreading the word, converting everyone to your religion. The kind of white man's burden, the idea that our culture, our civilization, our religion was so vastly superior to anyone else's that we were kind of doing everyone a favor by going out and taking over their countries. But we no longer believe that. It's hard to... We find it ludicrous. And go down and have a look in Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's and the kind of ridiculous monuments that they erected, you know, to generals and admirals of the previous century. Glorifying their warlike behavior. And when I go with the English people, they all feel slightly embarrassed by it and even cynical. Because that is a bygone age. And no longer, say, when we think of the Soviet Union as collapsed, or the FSU now in the newspapers, isn't it, former Soviet Union, is now become what we use instead of USSR, we say FSU. It shows the kind of collapse of the empire mentality. It's a strange time now because we don't know where we're going. We don't know what to do in a time and age without that kind of tension, without a clearly defined enemy and a competitive system and an economy based on the production of weapons and support of military, of the military. It seems to be no longer something that is going to be possible to try to dig up a new enemy. No one's ever going to replace the former Soviet Union. That was the best enemy you could have. But also, maybe we need to, it's like a maturing, because nations mature also. I mean, each one of us individually has our childhood, youth, young adult life, middle age, old age as a process. But we also have that as a nation. And I like to, this is just a reflection, is for you to consider, say here in Britain, for example, in Europe. The Europeans now are at a stage where there's been a lot of experience from the past. We look back and we can see all the mistakes we made when we were young, or the competitiveness, the romantic years, a self-assertion, the dominating tendencies, the arrogance and conceit that is very much a part of the arising side of life. Isn't it, as we get older, I find at my age, living with monks and nuns who are considerably younger than I am, it's interesting, because you see what youth is. It has a harder line to it. It's more idealistic, and it's more judgmental. I find as I get older, I become softer and more accepting and understanding, compassionate, because you realize how difficult life is. And when I was younger, I used to be very critical of the older generation, because they made all these mistakes. They did this wrong, they did that wrong. They shouldn't have done that. They should have done this. Can't they see it? And it's very, when you're 18, 19 years old, you think your parents just don't know anything. They're basically, you know, just not very clever and made a mess of their lives, and you're not going to do the same. And then 30, 40 years later, you've done like that. You've not improved all that much yourself. So you think, you begin to think, yeah, life is difficult, and to learn and to understand from life is what's important. We're not going to make this planet, this world, this country into an ideal society and universal and world system that is going to just totally please us, and it's not going to be a wonderful thing that we're going to see in our lifetime. We need maybe a vision of a kind of perfect society, a fair social system, a proper economic, a way of dealing with the economy and politics. We need those as guides, as ideas for kind of reference. But for all of us, life is something else. It's not politics or economics. It's our own feeling, our emotions, our fears, our desires, the way life is as a feeling experience. Contemplate just what birth is, since all of us have been born already, so that we know that birth has happened. That's the past. That's what has happened. That's why we're here. And the result of the birth is this way, isn't it? We're in this form, which is like being thrown out into a realm of sensitivity, where we have to feel everything for as long as this body is conscious. We will feel what impinges, what touches it. Sometimes when you're really mindful and concentrated in meditation, you get, I get the feeling, I get the image of like being a, of just one big open wound, like one big gash, open kind of gash in the universe that that is so sensitive and feels all the time, whatever the weather is, whatever happens, whatever you hear or see or smell or taste or touch. All these things irritate, agitate, touch us, or aggravate us, agitate us. And this sense of agitation and vulnerability is what we call sensory consciousness. So in when I have these this kind of vision, I feel very compassionate. I feel a lot of compassion for all beings, because you know that, that you can see why people are so desperate to try to protect themselves, because this is an experience where we are vulnerable. We feel everything. And I can see in my own life tendencies to try to escape from this sensitivity. It's frightening to be sensitive. It's better to not feel, not to know things, to find a little place, a little hole, a cave, or a protected environment where you can keep a measure of control, where you feel that you're in control anyway. And the more violent, unpleasant possibilities are kept at bay. If you can kind of create a womb-like atmosphere, an air-conditioned, centrally heated flat, with everything under control, and where your circle of friends are such that you know they're not going to upset you too much, may not make too many demands, not going to disappoint you, not going to betray you, or if because you might have been betrayed or hurt or disappointed by people in the past, one can try to live alone with a nice cat or a bird or a goldfish. Because goldfish is something you can keep with you in your flat. Cat, sometimes you have to let out in moments. But this way of keeping something that you feel safe and you can control and dominate. Because if we just leave ourselves open like a wound, an uncovered wound, unprotected, that image is rather gruesome. But in a way it's a good one to reflect upon, because to me that's very much why we have so much fear. We tend to oftentimes take it very personally, like we shouldn't be frightened. There's something neurotic or something wrong with me as a person, because if I were a normal, healthy man, you know, and my parents had been arahants instead of ordinary kind of people, and if everything had been perfect and right, I wouldn't have the fears and problems that I have as a human being. It's because I've been damaged. Maybe there's something done to me. Maybe I was raped when I was 2 years old and I can't remember it, or something. All possibilities or previous life experiences. Maybe I was, burned at the stake, or tortured, or by the Inquisition, or something or other. These are possibilities, but of ways of trying to explain the feelings or the fears, the anxieties that we experience in this life. Say when life isn't all that, when life is fairly safe and fairly controlled and fairly stable in a country like this. But also, there is this natural kind of instinctual sense of being of wanting to protect and defend ourselves. It's instinctive, isn't it? All creatures have it. When you're born as a separate creature in the jungle, in this realm where you can be brutalized or eaten or killed, exploited. We feel we must protect ourselves. And so that, say, is a natural, instinctual reaction to this state of vulnerability that we find ourselves in, this sensitive state we're in. We do have the ability, like civilization, or ways of forming groups to protect ourselves as tribes, as nations. And we can make moral agreements not to kill each other, that murder is a criminal offense, and stealing is a criminal offense, and rape and that is criminal offense, and perjury, and all these different things are ways of disrupting and causing division and fear in the society are called criminal offenses. And so most of us try to live by the laws of the land, by the and not necessarily the moral laws, but at least the civil laws. And many of us try to live by the moral laws also. And this gives us a feeling of security and safety. But still, even when you're living in a completely moral community such as this one, there's still this kind of fear as a part of our instinctual fear, which we meditate on in Buddhist meditation. We bring our attention to this fear, to this sense of anxiety or the sadness that one feels, a kind of deep sense of pathos that human beings have, rather than merely interpreting it as a kind of neurotic hang-up or personal failure. We begin to look at it as an experience of beginning to get in touch with it, to notice it, to learn how to accept it rather than to just shut it off or run away from it. And so the subject of death is one of those, isn't it, to bring that perception into our conscious experience. What does it do when we just say the word death? And what happens to me is my mind kind of stops for a moment, my thinking mind. I don't know what it is, physical death. I don't know what it'd be like to be dead. What happens? What happens when we die is one of the many questions. What do Buddhists believe? When you die, what happens to you? And of course you can believe all kinds of things. Reincarnation, some people believe in that, or rebirth, or going to heaven or hell, or you know, the Bardo plane, or the oblivion. We can have maybe different preferences that we might prefer one particular perception over another, but as an experience, we haven't died yet, and so in the way of reflection, we see we don't know. Death is unknown. It's in the future for us. Physical death is something that will happen in the future, and we bring our attention to the here and now. We establish mindfulness in the present. And in that establishment of mindfulness in the present, we realize that death is the unknown. As a practical experience of this moment, death to you, what is it? It's what you don't know. It's in the future for all of us. I hope no one's going to die right now anyway. Death also implies, when Ajahn Chah died last January in Thailand, noticed that even though he was ill and incapacitated for 10 years before he died, but this perception was Ajahn Chah is alive, even though he couldn't speak, and he was invalided and had to be nursed and taken care of for 10 years, 24 hours a day for 10 years, the monks had to look after him. But yet he was breathing and conscious, and so he was alive. There was still the perception of Ajahn Chah is alive. I went to Thailand last December, and I went to pay my respect to him while he was still alive. And he was obviously, he was sleeping at the time. There didn't seem to be much there, except the body was breathing. And when he did die, I noticed that there was a sense of grief, of feeling. I mean, even though one was very well prepared for his death for 10 years, it could have happened, quite easily. We expected it to happen much sooner than it did. But to hear the news, Ajahn Chah is dead, is that perception in the present moment, when you first hear it. Now I've gotten used to it. Ajahn Chah is dead. But the emotional response to that was a sense of grief, or what you call a sense of loss or separation. It was a natural response. It wasn't made on a kind of, one isn't wishing it to be otherwise or frightened or upset by it. But when I heard it, I felt that way. I was quite prepared for it, but it was a definite feeling. That even if it had been untrue, if somebody was just lying to me, it still would have felt that way. And that's why to encourage you to try to notice what you're actually feeling, how the power of words can shock you, can upset you, can bring you to tears, can bring you to joy and happiness, to laugh or to cry, isn't it? Just by the news or the gossip or the things that you hear, we're that sensitive. That's being sensitive. Our ability to use language and perceive things is that way. It makes us even more sensitive, you see, than the animal kingdom, which doesn't have a language. So a sheep, a ewe dies, the little lamb might feel a sense of grief at the loss of mother, but it isn't going to carry it around in a perception, won't remember. On the instinct level, it has maybe a flock memory of some sort, I don't know. But each one of us has, because of our reflective mind and our intelligence and our language and our ability to create perceptions, then of course that increases this sensitivity. It makes us neurotic, in other words. We can easily become neurotic because we can imagine things before they even happen. We can imagine the loss of our loved one long before they ever die, and we can become frightened and terrified and depressed over the possibility of the cat dying in the future. And this, but even though that is a bit ridiculous or absurd, yet that shows how sensitive we can be in some ways if we don't interpret it in the right way and we don't understand what our life is about and the state we're in. If we're merely operating from fears and desires and prejudices and superstitions, then the sensitivity we feel becomes sick. We become neurotic, and therefore we suffer before any real thing happens. We create suffering around us. Things that needn't be that much are given more impact, more power to arouse strong, painful feelings or fears in our mind. So in Buddhist meditation, we're trying to get it right, to see it in the right way. One thing, like the personality view, the sense of me, the strong sense of me as an individual, me as the body, me as this person, me with my achievements, my gifts, my attainments, me with my failures, me with my problems. This emphasis on me, in interpreting things, life always from me, means that I'm the center. Everything that happens is affecting me, and I become frightened, and I feel angry or bitter or resentful or offended by things that upset me or that affect me, that cause me distress, that disappoint me. So what we do is try to interpret it in a way of Dhamma, seeing the flow of life, experience of life, the sensitivity of it, in the terms of the way it is, and like Dhamma language that we use in Buddhism, is a skillful psychological use of words to try to think and use perception and develop the reflective mind and the intuitive abilities of our mind, so that we aren't taking personally just the natural flow of life's experience and the sensitivity that we feel. Because we become frightened and cowardly and jealous and miserable over the life's experiences that we always interpret as me. But when we begin to translate that into terms of Dhamma, then we begin to let go of it. We begin to trust more and are willing to be with the flow of our conscious experience, and willing to look more closely at the sadness we feel, or the pain, or the not knowing, the mysterious future, death, possible separation from the loved. Sometimes one hears, when you hear Buddhists talk, Buddhist monks or nuns talk, we oftentimes, the way it comes across is that we're trying to get beyond feeling. That somehow the idea of a Buddhist is being some kind of being, developing a being so mindful that you don't feel anything anymore. You don't experience grief. You don't experience anything other than just kind of an indifference to everything. And at one stage in my life, that sounded rather nice, because to feel life was frightening and overwhelming. And I felt very much I didn't want to feel. I'd like to get into one of those jhanic states where everything is outside of your consciousness, and you're concentrated only on some very fine point of blissful experience, and sustain that for as long as possible, so you don't have to feel anything, because feeling is frightening and unpleasant, unwanted. It hurts. I can't bear it. But actually what happens is that if you're meditating the right way, rather than shutting it out, you're willing to be a receptacle for feeling. You're willing to feel everything. You begin to kind of feel a sense of embracing the whole universe with your mind, and willing to accept all the sensitivity of that, good or bad, pleasant or painful. So that with mindfulness, rather than making this kind of a calloused kind of indifference, uncaring kind of being that just says everything's impermanent and it's all suffering, which is a kind of dismissal, isn't it? A put-down of life. And that's not what is meant by contemplating impermanence and suffering. what that means is to open to impermanence and suffering, not to just dismiss the world as somehow it's bad and worthless because it's impermanent and suffering. It's willing to experience, to embrace the suffering or the pain or the sensitivity, the sadness, the grief, the loss of the love, the separation. And by doing that, strangely enough, when you really do that, what happens? Rather than getting depressed, it takes you to a state of being peaceful. And the sadness of life then, rather than being depressing sadness, is kind of transformed into a kind of calm, a balanced state, it's sensitive but balanced rather than balanced insensitive. I find though 26 years as a monk has increased sensitivity. I mean, there was so much effort to not be sensitive when I first ordained, to not feel, fear of feeling, frightening, embarrassing, isn't it? You're brought up in my generation in the States, men aren't supposed to feel things, you're supposed to be strong. Feeling is a weak thing, isn't it? Women feel, so they're weak. Men are strong, they don't feel anything. This is the kind of messages I was getting in the society I grew up in. You don't, like crying was a sign of weakness. So men, you're embarrassed about it. If somebody saw you crying, you were just totally embarrassed because people would think you were weak. Women would look at you and say, he's a weak man, he cries. And no decent woman would want to have anything to do with a weak man. sensitivity was something that was a sign of weakness, whereas strength and willpower, conquering, domineering, controlling, these were signs of success. The success story, the magnet, the self-made man that got to the top through an act of will, stronger than the rest. These were the images, role models. So the tendency towards any feeling, intuitive understanding, or sensitivity was feared and rejected. And because of that, one becomes alienated and lonely. I noticed the more negative you are, the more alienated you feel. When you hate somebody or hate yourself, or you feel bitter or you feel worthless, you feel unloved, you feel that you're just caught in a state of just negative feelings about yourself and the world. You create the impression around you that you are alienated and separated. The separation is very much a sense of your own critical faculties operating. It because the negative perceptions that you're generating create around you a sense of separation and alienation. That's the way the mind is. When you hate somebody, you're emphasizing a separateness. Love is unitive, isn't it? Its purpose is to unite, cohesion. So when we love, when we feel love for people, then we feel a kind of oneness with them. We feel united. We feel a communion, a union. So when we're in a state of loving, then we feel a sense of having friends and being part of a community, and we have the pleasure of that kind of feeling, just by the perceptions of love, liking, positive thinking. So we note that our this ability to perceive ourselves in the world in positive and negative terms is this way. Love is moving towards the oneness or the totality, the union, the universe, and anger, hatred, aversion is towards the separation, alienation. Now this mind we have has inclines very easily to one or the other. Many of us, I think, in the modern society have, through education, we're educated to be more on the negatives, to develop a critical mind. Isn't it? So we value our critical faculties very much. And so the kind of more intuitive, loving side has not been held up as being anything worth cultivating, even though we kind of sentimentalize about romantic love and we think it's nice kind of pretty stories and fairy tales and all that, and we certainly like the idea of it. But what is regarded as important and real, the real world, is what we tend to use the negative perceptions for. What's wrong, or the fault? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with you? The blaming. Notice how when the last week with the money market going all over the place, how everybody's out blaming somebody. To the Germans. So death itself as a negative perception gives us a sense of separation from the love. Now, like with Lungpa Cha, as a perception of death, you know, Ajahn Chah is dead. There's a, because of the impact of the word dead, it tends to, we tend to have regarded as a negative perception. So there's a feeling of separation from Ajahn Chah. He's dead now. And also, we don't know where he is. Where did he go? Or did he go anywhere? We don't know. And when we don't know, we feel very uncomfortable and frightened and anxious over not knowing things. Now, in dealing with death and separation and grief, it's what we can know is these are what we're feeling. Like when somebody dies, especially if somebody close to you dies, you feel grief. Is the word I use for that feeling of separation or not knowing or the loss. Death is a final thing, isn't it? Where if they go away, if somebody, you know, somebody you love is going on a journey, they say, well, we'll see you again. We'll meet in again next month. And even with ordinary people that we're not particularly close to, it's hard to say sometimes goodbye as if it were going to be final, isn't it? The more you enjoy somebody or like them or appreciate them, then the more difficult it is to put finality even into a goodbye. We say, see you again. When do we meet again? Let's have another meeting. And these are the words we use to convey that we'll meet again. But death means we won't meet again. That's the impact of finality and the unknown. So we can know that, to use that sense, that to go to that feeling, to embrace that feeling, will take you to a place where you can feel at ease and at peace with it. A sense of real peace, because you're no longer trying to to figure it out, analyze it, build perceptions around it, or just try to fend it off and ignore it. But you are accepting exactly what you're feeling in the moment. You're not trying to make anything out of it. You're just learning how to feel life. It's this way. It's like this, at this moment, this when this perception, Ajahn Chah is dead, it feels this way. And we listen, we watch, we accept, and we train ourselves not to make anything out of it, not try to get analytical or rational about it, but to more or less abide with that state of sensitivity as is. And I found that quite difficult, actually, personally, to do that, because my mind always was a mind that likes to figure things out. So it is always going on, trying to figure it out. And to learn to let go of that's been quite a hard work, actually, because that feeling, like feeling the wound, being a wound, there was incredible kind of restlessness of my conditioned mind wanting to make something out of it, rather than to just accept it, be this way, be sensitive, be like an open sore, an open wound, just be it, accept that state of being. And by doing that, the mind became very, very still. It went into just this beautiful state of stillness and clarity, rather than sinking into depression and despair. This is something for you to consider in dealing with these experiences of life that we are all going to have. It's something that we can learn from, open to, even treasure, and to respect and appreciate in our life as a human being, because these are important. This is an important event. Our own death, isn't it? Is an important event. It might not be to anyone else, but it is to each one of us, because that's the way it is. So I would like to consider death then not as a kind of miserable kind of end of a life, but maybe the most important event of it, where we use our lives for opening ourselves up to suffering, to grief, to separation, to all that we tend to try to resist and reject. We begin to open up to it, so that when the actual physical death comes, then it is like a victory, a kind of great event in our life, rather than a kind of miserable, drugged, frightened, panic-stricken, bitter experience. The sadness then that we feel is a part of. There's always a sad, like in the this human realm that we live in, isn't it? It's sorrow and joy and sorrow and joy, where there's sorrow, there's going to also be the possibility for joy. And where there's joy, there's also sorrow connected to it. It's just the way it is. It's not that it should be another way. So our life in this human form, treasure it as something to watch and learn from. See it as not to take it personally, not to want it to be something it can't be, but to understand it as it is, so that you're learning the lessons from it. It's a great opportunity. We're in a very unique form in this universal system, this human form. It's quite unique, and it is a life of where we do. We're an open wound. From the time you're born to the time you die. Try to feel that. And just see how sensitive it is when you stop thinking and trying to avoid and run away from everything. Just sitting still and seeing what it's like to have to see and look at things or hear things or feel with the body. And without judging it, not trying to figure it out in terms of how it should be, but as it is, as a existing experience, it's this way. And so then, to me, the obvious insight into that is it's what we must learn from. We learn from our own, the way we are, our own karma, in Buddhist terms. Each one of us has our own unique karma to work with. So the way we are, the way our own particular inclinations, tendencies, traits, abilities are not to be seen in terms of, not to be interpreted on the level of me and mine anymore, but to be understood in terms of Dhamma, that we learn from this. We learn what we need to know within the limits and constraints of our human conscious experience. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know everything about everything. You can know everything about the way it is from the way you are. That also is a good reflection, which we can accept the infinite variety of types and characters. Remember the kind of smug, youthful callousness when I were, used to think somebody shouldn't be the way they are. And we used to get quite uppity, and we think, look at that person, he's really, he shouldn't be that way. Well, why does she act like that? If I don't act like that, why does she have to act like that? And one can be very cruel and insensitive, because we tend to judge everyone else by our own character, our own inclination, in which we're inevitably going to get it all wrong. To think that everyone should react and think and do and feel like I do is when I perceive the world in that way, I can only feel frustrated and angry because nobody else does exactly feel and act the way I do. And I'm glad they don't. But also, we find through this kind of reflection an appreciation for variety rather than picking and choosing. Selecting, say, these are the ones that are worth, these are the people you will associate with, those you have nothing to do with. And that we don't need any ethnic cleansing. We're quite happy with variety, with the differences, with the faults, with the peculiarities, with the perversity. All these can be accepted. And not resented or hated or feel threatened by, because we begin to say we must learn from this. from the way we think and feel, the emotions that we find that we're experiencing, and getting beyond the just emotional reactiveness, but we need to see the emotions, accept them, and be patient rather than judgmental and repressive. And then through that process, I see now the possibility upon my death as a, if I keep practicing in the right way, I see that it's nothing to be frightened of. Because the work has been done. We're learning from our lives. We're open. We're willing to experience life in the way that it happens to us, and learn from it. Learn how to learn from our experience, so that we're not committing the same mistakes over and over again. So that's enough of the formal talk this afternoon. We can have a break, cup of tea, and then in about 15, 20 minutes we can resume and have questions and answers.